Instead of writing a sermon today, I thought that I would share an interesting perspective since I wouldn't usually be able to interview someone who lives in New Jersey since we're in Michigan. But this is my friend Emily Chesley, who is doing a doctorate at Princeton University because I have very smart friends. We met in seminary and she grew up in Chad, which is here in Africa. Her parents were there as missionaries doing some Bible translation work. So she has a very different perspective on world Christianity for this World Communion Sunday. So hi, Emily.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. Yeah, I grew up in an sort of an area in central Chad among a people group called the Migami. They speak the Migama language, which is spoken by about 20,000 people. And my parents were there doing Bible translation and linguistics. So the church in Chad, what in that particular part of Chad among Migami, was on it every week, might have 3 or 4 or 5 different languages going on in the service because people speak, their mother tongue was Migama, the language of the tribe, sort of the ethnic language. But then Chadian Arabic was one of the trade languages. You figure Chad has around 126 tribal languages, ethnic languages. And so communicating with one another for mercantile ventures, you kind of need a common language. And so especially nomadic traders that would kind of come through selling goods would speak Chadian Arabic. So that was kind of the trade language. And then French is was the language of education and government, so all of the schools were run in French. And so those were sort of the three big language players, so to speak. But then if there were guests from a different part of Chad who spoke a different language, then we might throw in a song from their language to sort of welcome them into the mix. And it's really interesting to think about sort of from the faith perspective. My parents were there as Bible translators, like I said, and how do you translate the Bible if your language doesn't have a word for something in the Bible? So how do you translate a parable about the vineyards if your language doesn't have a word for grape, because grapes don't grow in a desert? It just really, you have to sort of think in different ways about the gospel story and faith.
So what ends up being the substitution for grapes?
I think if I recall correctly from many, many years ago, you end up describing it. So you describe it as a fruit from which you extract liquid that can become a drink, an alcoholic drink or something like that. Or there might be so that's one option, or another option that you could sometimes will choose in translation is to pick a word from a different language that is sort of commonly used in your language. Sort of the word fiance in English, technically it came from French, but we use it in English. And so that's a word that everyone would understand, but that's kind of a choice that the translation committee would make as to what word you use or not. And then they go through a series of process of checking those translations after they've done it with native speakers to kind of understand, to kind of see if everyone is understanding the way that they translated it. Does it actually communicate what the original Greek or Hebrew meant?
Wow. So how long does it take for the Bible to be translated into a new language like that?
It depends on a lot of factors. The Migama translation actually was, my parents moved to the village and I was around 4, 1996, I think. I'm not a math person, do humanities. But actually it was just finished being typeset this past week.
Cool.
Yeah, about 24 years in this case, because there at the very beginning, you started with having to create a writing system for the language because it had never been written down before. And so you kind of start from the very beginning of figuring out the writing system, learning the grammar of the language, because every language has a grammar internally, but you kind of have to write it down and figure out what that grammar is.
Not having a written language is just kind of, I can't imagine that, because a written language is so central to my understanding of language.
Yeah, and it actually affects the way that the church, like the Bigami church, kind of would communicate the gospel in certain ways. So a really common thing in Chad was oral Bible storying, which is where, because it was an oral culture, people are really good at memorizing, right? Because that's the way that you're trained to pass down stories and like folklore from generation to generation. And if you're trained to memorize, you're trained not to forget things. It's not sort of like in our world, like I have to write something down on my iPhone, like notes to remember it, right?
Google effect.
But if that's like what you're trained to do, you can memorize something exactly. And so people would memorize precise Bible stories sort of in chronological order with the exact translation that had been determined was accurate to the story, and then sort of set up storytelling groups where once or twice a week they would sit down with people in their community and recite these Bible stories, and then afterward ask follow-up questions to sort of ensure people understand. But that was one way of transmitting the New Testament or the Old Testament, but in a way that would reach people who maybe were not literate in that language. Or even if they were literate, maybe it wasn't like sort of the way that it would normally speak to them. Yeah. And another thing that the Bigami Church would do was take traditional folk songs and melodies and set, write new lyrics with Bible stories. So that then these were songs that people would like normally sing, like when working in the fields. And by putting new words to them, there's a way of like memorizing and hearing these songs. So sometimes you would hear like local village kids who didn't come to church, but just singing these songs because they knew this, they knew the melody, and they had learned these new words from their acquaintances and friends. And that was like another way of taking the Bible and putting it in a way that like would reach people.
Is it harder to have like congregational singing if you don't have the words in front of you, or does everybody just know all these songs?
That's a great question. So a lot of the songs are like known, because you sort of sing them over and over again week to week, but also the style of the songs, and this is partly the traditional style of singing, is that you have a verse and then like a refrain. But so you might have one person who's kind of the designated song leader that would sing the verse, and then everyone sings the refrain. And so it goes through, there might be like 27 verses or like 27 verses, but like a verse is maybe like two lines, right? And so there can kind of be like call and response that way, where if the congregation might not have memorized all 27 verses, that maybe like go through the story of the creation, but they maybe have memorized the refrain that says God created Adam and Eve and the world or something, right? Then in that way, even if you don't know necessarily the whole song, everyone sings together, if that makes sense.
That does. Yeah, kind of a call and response like a lot of spirituals are.
Yeah, that's a good analogy.
Makes sense. That is just so different from the way I think of leading church.
Yeah, it's like very participatory. And often like even in services, there wouldn't necessarily be a plan of like which songs we're going to sing ahead of time. So like in the middle of the service, whoever was sort of directing the service that day, I guess you might call them the MC, would just sort of call on the men, like, oh, can you give us a song to sing? Or like call on the women, like, pick a song. And then there's sort of be discussion amongst everyone, like, okay, which song we want? Okay, let me pick the song. And often the song, it wouldn't be identified by a number necessarily in the book, but the first line of the song.
Yeah, I guess it would kind of depend on a day-to-day basis of who was there and what songs they knew. So that would be harder to plan ahead for.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So if grapes are so unusual in the culture, how does communion work? Is it still grape wine?
That is a great question. And actually I cannot
think it's a grape question. Sorry.
It is a great question. So I actually never took communion in the church in Bato because in the Chadian context, there's you can only take communion when you're baptized. And there's a very long process as to when you're allowed to become baptized. And it's predominantly adults, partially by virtue of the majority of Christians are adult converts from Islam. And then because of kind of the context of social persecution, the church requires a 2-year-long course before you can become baptized, sort of in catechesis and doctrine. And they want to essentially ensure that A, you know what you're getting into, and also that you're not going to recant and go back to Islam, because they don't want people who have been baptized and who have partaken of communion going back because of persecution, which is a very real thing. Like, people have their marriages annulled or their crops destroyed if they convert to Christianity. And so because of that, there's actually only very few. When I was a kid, there were not very many people who were baptized and were allowed to take communion. And so the way the service would work actually is we would have an entire worship service, the singing, the prayers, the offering, the sermon, and it would end and everyone would exit the church. And the way we exit, like, we sing as we go, and like everyone shakes hands with everyone in a circle outside. And then after that service was over, there would be a separate service where the people who had been baptized would go back inside for a communion service. And I and my siblings were baptized as infants in a church, in the Lutheran church in the US, but in order to respect that culture and that context where children would not have been baptized, we did not take part in those communion services. So that's a very long way of saying that I don't actually know how communion was served. If it was grape juice that was imported, if it was like a special tea, there was kind of a hibiscus tea that sometimes people would make that kind of looks red, maybe that was used.
Wow. Yeah, I know there are a lot of churches who have a very closed communion. Like, I couldn't take communion at a Catholic church. Yeah. But there's not that many churches today that have that level of closed communion. That's very similar to how, like, the first couple centuries of Christianity would have done that, where there was even the front part of the church where the baptismal font was, and if you weren't baptized, you couldn't even go past the that part of the church.
Absolutely. I do think that having the separate service for communion is also kind of a way of respecting, not wanting people to feel left out, you know, if you only have, say, 4 or 5 people who are sort of authorized by the denomination to take communion, you don't want to have a service, and in the middle of the service, only for these 4 people are singled out, you know, so that can also kind of like create like more inclusivity in a way, sort of a feeling of belonging.
So are there any other takeaways or things that you think people don't know about Chad or Africa in general, or growing up abroad, that you think people should know?
I think it's always just good to be aware of how, so I was really surprised when like I moved to the US and discovered how big denominations were, and sort of you ask people, oh, are you, people sort of identify with a particular denomination. And I think there was a study in 2011 that there was something like 33,000 Christian denominations in the world, which is a lot. And that was very foreign to me, because growing up in the context where I did, where the majority of the population in our village were 99% Muslim, a very small Christian population. There was a tiny Protestant church, a slightly larger but still very small Catholic church, and you didn't ask people what Christian affiliation they were. You asked them, like, do you believe in Jesus? And so I sort of grew up in a context where that sort of sense of unity around belief in Christ was the, like, kind of a drawing centripetal factor. And I think as I've grown older and like went to seminary, I sort of studied theology, I definitely see the value in knowing your particular tradition and what doctrine and beliefs you hold. But I also think there's a lot to be learned from that sense of communal identity as like brothers and sisters in Christ, where the main question doesn't have to be like, how do you practice baptism? Or what's your position on this small point of doctrine? It's like very valuable, right? But also, what do we share in common? I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that is really cool. And unity is certainly a main theme of World Communion Sunday. So I'm glad that you make that connection also.
And I'm very grateful to have friends like you who listen and ask questions. I think that's the most important thing that we can do, to try and learn and to recognize when maybe we don't know something. And like, yeah, I'm very much still learning, even from you and from the people around me here in this context.
Well, thanks for talking with us this morning, Emily.
Thanks for having me. Have a great rest of your Sunday.